I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Shortly after Donald Trump won the presidency, Masha Gessen wrote a cautionary article for The New Yorker, Autocracy Rules for Survival. It was based on their years covering Vladimir Putin and living most of their life in an autocracy, Russia. Among the rules, believe the autocrat. Do not be taken in by small signs of normality. Institutions will not save you. Be outraged. Gessen lives in the U.S. now and has a new book, Surviving Autocracy, about what they've observed living under more than 3 years of President Trump. They write, quote, Trump was probably the first major party nominee who ran not for president, but for autocrat. They also decry the neutral tone and normalizing language the press often uses when covering Trump and how the pandemic is the perfect disaster for Trump. Masha Gessen is a staff writer for The New Yorker, author of about a dozen books, including The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, which won the National Book Award. They're distinguished writer in residence at Bard College, and they join us by Skype. And Masha Gessen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Do we have her? We will have her. Okay, she's there. I am not hearing her, but Masha Gessen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Nice to have you with us as well. And to our listeners, to join our conversation, several ways you can do it. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You write that Donald Trump made a, quote, autocratic attempt on America. This is some language that was coined by a Hungarian sociologist. What does that mean, an autocratic attempt on America?
So I do use the work of my really intellectual hero, Balint Magyar, who is a Hungarian sociologist. And he has done something very interesting. He's gone back to 1989 and talked about the fact that when the Soviet bloc collapsed, we were using the language of liberal democracy to talk about what was happening in those countries, partly because we assumed that liberal democracy was what was going to just happen there, because what else would happen? And partly because that's the language of political science. That's what we talk about mm-hmm. when we talk about countries. We talk about whether they have free and fair elections. We talk about whether they have freedom of the media. And his argument is that that's great when you're talking about an actual liberal democracy. Not so good when you're talking about something else, because just talking about the absence of something or a flawed something doesn't tell you about the nature of the thing. And so he has developed a vocabulary for talking about autocracy, and he has a 1,000-page book on that coming yeah. out in a few weeks. I thought that there was some poetic justice in borrowing the language that he developed for communist countries, but also it's incredibly useful. Obviously, you can just take it and transpose it to what's happening in the U.S. now. You know, the U.S. is not Hungary, it's not Poland, it's not Russia, but it is the beginning of a model, right? And so what he talks about is that autocracy is established in three stages. The first stage is autocratic attempt. Then comes the autocratic breakthrough, and then autocratic consolidation. And autocratic attempt is the stage that where it's still reversible by electoral means. So we have to assume that at least until November, we're an autocratic attempt. We're seeing Donald Trump attack and destroy our system of checks and balances. We're seeing him establish rule by decree, establish the rule of one man, which is basically what autocracy is. But at this point, the process is not complete. Not all checks and balances are gone, and we still have access to electoral institutions.
You have written a lot about Vladimir Putin and other autocrats as well. How would you describe the kind of autocrat, to use your language, the autocrat that Donald Trump is? Is he a good one? And by that mean, is he an effective one?
Well, that's a great question. How do you measure the effectiveness of an autocrat? If we measure it in terms of good government, he's obviously not very effective. I mean, the disaster of handling the coronavirus pandemic, and we're still in the early stages of that disaster, is a good illustration of that. But that is not how he views power. He does not view his political role as saving lives or protecting American lives. He views his political role and the point of being president as accumulating money and power. And in that, I think he's been pretty effective.
How would you compare him, though, to Putin? And you've written a lot about this. In many ways, Putin is a more kind of, I guess, wily autocrat and more secretive. And it seems that so much of what President Trump does is so obvious and out in the open.
Yeah, I don't know if Putin is particularly secretive, actually. And I would not call him wily. I think temperamentally, they're really different. You know, I mean, all you have to do is take a look at any of their speeches and you see, you know, Putin imagines himself as somebody who's very reserved, whose emotions are always in check. And Trump is raw emotion. That's part of his appeal. But there are a lot of things that they do similarly. And, you know, I want to be very clear. I'm not I don't think that having written about Putin qualifies me to write about Donald Trump. They're really hugely different. And the political cultures and contexts of the two countries are very different. It's just that I have spent most of my career thinking about autocracies and how, you know, what happens to societies in an autocracy, how we give up our agency, when we actually choose to forfeit freedom, psychologically and sociologically, what happens to us. And that's much of what the book is about.
Sure.
Right. It's what has happened to society. But getting back to comparing Putin and Trump, in some ways, there are certain things that they do that are similar and that my having written about Putin helps me recognize. Like, for example, how they use language, how they lie. They both employ what I call the power lie, the lie where, you know, the point of it is not to make you believe something that you didn't believe earlier, right? It's not to convince you that the dog ate your homework. It's or my homework. It's to say that I can say whatever I want whenever I want to, right? And that's very different. That's like when Donald Trump lies about the weather, which we can empirically check the moment he talks about it, you know, which is blatant and absurd. Like when he says that during his inaugural speech, the sun came out. It didn't. It was raining. We can still see it on videotape, right? That the sun didn't come out for a second that day. But he lies about the weather. And so what is he saying? He's saying, I have the biggest microphone. You have to engage with what I say, no matter what I say. I'm going to lie, and what are you going to do about it?
In fact, you call it the power lie or the bully lie. It is a lie of the bigger kid who took your hat and is wearing it while denying that he took it.
Exactly. Exactly. It's, you know, it's not a terribly cunning political strategy. It's something that we know from the schoolyard.
But it makes you question, you meaning the public, makes you question your own sanity in reality when someone says something that it is when it actually isn't.
It makes you question your own sanity. And I think also it's just really hard to live in a country where there are these two distinct realities, right? The reality that is given to you in your perceptions and in your experience, and the reality that he is putting across. There's a kind of stress, almost, you know, a sense of dread that we live with because of that. And there's a temptation. I mean, you can, you know, you can continue to live in this intellectually strenuous state of constantly having to deal with the fact that we have, you know, there's a fact-based reality, and then there's the president's absurd reality, or you can just give yourself over to it. There's a kind of open invitation, just, you know, come and inhabit my reality fully, and then you don't feel the tension.
Let me play something, and this goes back a couple of years. In fact, it's candidate Trump. He's speaking at the Republican National Convention. This is July 2016, so almost 4 years ago, when he is accepting the Republican nomination. Let's give it a listen, and then I have a question for you.
Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it.
Namashii got obviously big applause there, but more recently, in dealing with the COVID-19, the pandemic crisis, he said, "I don't take responsibility at all." And that is for the crisis. So you've got, on the one hand, only I alone can fix it, but when it came to fixing it, I am not responsible.
You know, it's a fascinating aspect of Trump, but also actually this is another way in which he and Putin are similar. And I think I think he's similar to many other autocrats, these kinds of, you know, populist autocrats that we have seen rise over the last number of years, where they're always campaigning against this imaginary government. I mean, first when they campaign against the government as such. And there's a huge difference between campaigning against the sitting president, or, you know, the power, the party in power, which is what sort of in a normal election you would see the Republican candidate do during a Democratic presidency. And then there is campaigning against the government as such, mm-hmm. right? Campaigning on a platform of destruction. When Donald Trump said drain the swamp, he meant dismantle government as it's currently constituted. And so that's what he's saying. You know, nobody knows the system better than I do. Again, empirically false. You know, easy to prove that he has no government experience. And yet, and I alone can fix it. And that's a promise of, you know, I'm going to go in and really shake things up, really. And then he goes in and he appoints to head every federal agency somebody who's actually opposed to the mission of that agency, right? But the fascinating thing is that when he is president, and he's been president for 3.5 years, he continues to, in a way, campaign against government, right? That campaign of destruction continues, and it's as though someone else were running things, and he has nothing to do with it. Responsibility doesn't stick to him.
And would you say it's working?
Again, it depends on your definition of working. Is that... is he a good president? Obviously, no. Has he maintained his base? It seems that to a large extent he has maintained his base. I mean, I'm very, very cautiously optimistic about the current polls. I know that Joe Biden is leading in the polls by double digits, which is great. But I think it's early. And I think also we have to be just super careful with polling, because polling and kind of a lot of the metrics that we apply to our situation come from an old political reality. And right now we have half the country living in a functional electoral democracy and half the country living in an autocracy. And for that country, to some extent, it's still working. You know, we saw Donald Trump's approval ratings at an all-time high during, you know, at the very height of the COVID lockdown.
Well, hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very sharp break, talking with Masha Gessen about their new book, Surviving Autocracy. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty, I'm Marty Moscoin, and I'm talking with Masha Gessen, who joins us to discuss their new book about President Trump. It's titled Surviving Autocracy. It's about Trump's regard for dictators, his use of language to obfuscate and confuse, and some of the challenges which we'll talk about of the press has in covering him. And again, you can join our conversation at Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I do, though, think of Donald Trump as a very American creation. He's flashy. He's profane. He's ambitious. He's ego-driven. He has disdain for expertise. This feels very American to me. How would you describe, I guess, the conditions that led to his successful bid for the White House? How far back do you think we have to go?
That is such a great question. I'm really happy to hear you say that you see him as a very American creation.
Absolutely.
Because I think that's a key aspect of understanding Trump. And, you know, we usually have two ways of talking about Trump. We either talk about him as a very sort of American creation, or we talk about him as an anomaly, almost like an alien from outer space who came and changed things drastically. And the thing is, I think that it's possible to sort of hold both those thoughts in our heads at the same time. There are conditions that were laid for Trump's rise that precede Trump. They made him possible. They didn't make him inevitable. I don't think he was predetermined, right? But they made him possible. And I think that what the political conditions I'm referring to are the changes that we've seen, particularly since 9/11, right? The concentration of power in the executive branch, the sense of ourselves as a nation under siege, you know, always against another, always under attack. And I think Trump has used that changed understanding of the presidency, but also changed the understanding of us, ourselves, to incredible effect. And in that way, and of course, the third thing is the relationship between money and politics, right, which has always been very significant in the United States, but in the last dozen years or so has just spiraled out of control, right? And he's used it both practically and aesthetically. Right. I mean, we understand money and politics to be inseparable. And there he comes and says, you know, I'm a rich man, I'm a billionaire, I'm a businessman. And that somehow to us also signals power.
I'm sorry. I also was wondering, thinking about the presidency of Barack Obama, whether that led us to Donald Trump, not because of, you know, not that Obama wanted that to happen, but also the recession and how that created the Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street. I think it exposed the sort of winners and losers in this country, the divide between the rich and everybody else. And I think a lot of people just feel as if the system, as it is comprised, does not work and does not work for me.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that a lot of what Trump was able to tap into is this resentment that I've played by the rules and you told me I have to vote my pocketbook. I voted my pocketbook, and my pocketbook just keeps getting thinner and thinner, right? But it's also extreme anxiety, and I think this is where we really go from kind of, you know, regular sort of Republican resentment voting to really wanting an autocrat. Mm. Right? And there's a lot of great social science from the 20th century on when people just feel so anxious, when imagining the future becomes such a burden and so frightening that somebody comes along and says, I'm going to take you back to the imaginary past. I'm going to transport you magically to a place where you felt comfortable and you felt secure. And people say, yes, I will give up my liberty. I will give up everything just to be in your hands. Just take control and take me back to that safe place. And that's what Trump, that's his emotional deal.
Let me read a couple of comments. We had a caller who left a message, and he said, this is Rick, one of the big differences between the U.S. and Russia is that we have 10,000 news outlets that keep our government in check. Russia only has 3. Masha Gessen, can you speak to that?
That is absolutely true. We have a lot. I don't know if we have 10,000. We have a lot of news outlets, and Russia has, I'd say that's an accurate count for the number of actually independent news outlets, but that wasn't always so. Right. When Putin came to power, Russia had a robust media scene. I don't know that I would compare it to the U.S. Media scene, and sort of certainly doesn't have the kind of long tradition and the kind of media culture. But there were a lot of great media outlets, including a terrific federal news channel that was very anti-Putin, and it was easy for Putin within a year to take over them. Now, in the United States, and this is where I use Magyar's work more than any comparison to Russia.
The Hungarian,
thank you. In the United States, we're not going to, I don't think, see the state take over media. But there's a more useful concept, which is the concept of dominating in the information sphere. And that's something that Trump does incredibly effectively. Right. Even with our amazing news outlets such as the New York Times, you know, there's a constant struggle to cover Trump in a way that doesn't perpetuate the harms, that at least aims to reduce the harm that he is doing to a sense of shared reality. And that's a constant uphill battle.
As I mentioned in my introduction, this is tricky stuff, which is, how to cover Donald Trump in a way that reveals, I guess, the truth about what he says and what he does. But you also caution and are critical of the press for its, quote, neutral tone or even normalizing language when it comes to the president. And I wonder sort of how you find, I guess, that sweet spot.
Well, I don't think there is a sweet spot, actually. I think that we have to admit that we're in deep, deep trouble with covering Trump, because Trump himself, sort of the lying president, the president who uses words to mean nothing, to wreak havoc, he is an existential threat to journalism. In a sense, it's impossible to cover. So, take Donald Trump, who says, most recent example, that he has ordered a slowdown of testing so that we have fewer cases. And then he says, oh, I was kidding. And then he repeats it again. And then he repeats it again. Right. So he is saying something that is completely crazy. And then he says, yeah, that didn't mean anything. And then he repeats it, right? So he is creating this sense that what he says is in itself unreliable, that what he says is meaningless, and yet it has real consequences. It has actual consequences the moment he says it, because his office is so powerful. And so how do you cover a meaningless mm-hmm. statement that has consequences? That is almost impossible.
Well, and it's I was kidding, and no, I wasn't kidding. And again, the kind of whiplash. Let me play, and this goes back a couple of years, but I think speaks to what you're talking about. This is July 2018, and President Trump is speaking at a Veterans Association and suggesting that they stop believing the press and just listen to what he has to say. Let's give it a listen.
Just stick with us. Don't believe the crap you see from these people, the fake news. And just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening.
So Moshe Gessen, he's saying, in a sense, don't believe your lying eyes.
Right. He says, don't believe your lying eyes. Come and live with me in my reality. And again, that's incredibly tempting. But it also means that you become entirely dependent on Donald Trump. Because, of course, if you can't believe your lying eyes, you only can know what's going on if you listen to him. Right. That's a real totalitarian move. And, I'm by no means saying that we're seeing the rise of totalitarianism in this country. Totalitarianism has many features, most of which are, at this point at least, unthinkable in the United States. But Donald Trump is a totalitarian type leader. And this is like one of his moves. He says, in order to know what's going on, you have to listen to me and read my Twitter feed. There is no other way to know what the reality is, because it is only what I say.
I've heard journalists say, just cover what he does, not what he says. Does that address what you have described here?
I don't think that's a solution, actually. There are many pat solutions that we have heard, like, oh, let's cover him as a silent movie. ignore his tweets. You can't ignore his tweets, right? You can't ignore his tweets because he's president and because his tweets have consequences. He issued the ban on transgender people in the military by tweet, right? They can even have consequences for thousands and thousands of people and for actual policymaking. But I think the answer is to always try to cover Trump as a system, right? Try to avoid covering any piece of Trump news, as a piece of policy, as a presidential statement, things that normalize him. Right. When he writes an insane letter to Kim Jong-un and we cover it as diplomacy, that normalizes that kind of behavior, that makes that be diplomacy, right? But covering it as a symptom of Trumpism, as part of this thing that we're observing that we're always struggling to describe and define, I think maybe at least helps mitigate the harm.
Stephen from Collingswood left a comment. He said, quote here, autocracy is a euphemism. It's too mild. These people are dictators. Why don't we say it? You're all about language, Masha Gessen. Why autocracy and not dictatorship?
Well, there are synonyms. It's actually not a euphemism.
Okay.
Autocracy is the rule of one man. It's this sort of top-down rule. And look, I'm using the word autocracy for a reason. Most of the time, especially when Donald Trump was first running for office and first elected, a lot of people were using the word authoritarian to describe his tendencies. Now, I think that authoritarian is the wrong word, and perhaps Steve is confusing authoritarian and autocracy. Authoritarian is the kind of regime where politics sort of disappears, where you see where people go home and tend to their private lives, and a person or a group of people are running the country and without oversight. That's not the kind of politics that Trump wants. He actually he's much more totalitarian in his desires. He wants everything to be political, right? Under totalitarianism, the private sphere disappears and everything becomes political. He wants people in the public square declaring their support for him. Right? So he's not authoritarian, he's a totalitarian type leader, but we are not in totalitarianism. There are, again, lots of things that are not happening that would be totalitarian. But he is an autocrat in the sense that he sees, you know, the power of one man, the rule by decree, the sort of the right to the entitlement to adulation as necessary attributes of power. So that's why I use that word, and I use it to draw attention to that.
And I am, I am talking to Masha Gessen. They've got a new book. It's called Surviving Autocracy. And we've been talking about President Trump. They're also a distinguished writer in residence at Bard College. And Masha Gessen has written about a dozen books. She grew up in Russia and she lives in the United States. Excuse me. They live in the United States now.
That's okay.
I'm working really hard. It's very important. I feel very, very strongly about using correct pronouns. So I apologize for saying that. And again, we're going to talk more. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me just pick up on that, Masha Gessen, because I know how important this is to you, and it is to me as well. And just to, you know, again, sort of apologize, because I feel very, very strongly about making sure that people are described in the language that matters to them and suits who they are.
I'm sorry, Marty, I just lost you for like a second.
That's okay. I was just talking about pronouns and just how important they are. That's all I just wanted to make.
Thank you so much. No, I really appreciate the care and attention. And I know sometimes it's awkward.
Old habits.
Thank you.
Here's another caller that says, what does Masha Gessen think is happening with Trump and his relationship with the military? Seems like he's lost their support as we see more generals speaking out against him. How significant is that? And just picking up on that, I'm thinking what happened at Lafayette Square just a couple of weeks ago. Protesters were pushed aside in many ways by the military so that he could have a photo op with a Bible in front of a church. Mattis came out after that. Some people have seen this as a bit of a turning point. How do you see it?
I think it's important. I'm not thrilled about it. I'm particularly not thrilled about what happened with, Mattis is at this point not part of the administration, but we did see two members of the administration. First, the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, and then General Mark Milley, I think, who's the Joint Chief of Staff, Joint Chief of Staffs, distanced themselves from this incident.
Right.
Although it took the latter a week, it took Esper a day. But both of them kind of said, you know, we didn't know this was happening. Right. This we were following the president. They were both there. We were following the president blindly. We didn't know where we were going. Not a great defense and not particularly reassuring to think that our military brass follows the president blindly, doesn't even ask where they're going and what they're going to do there. But it is a sign that when he becomes really toxic, when the association with him becomes politically untenable, the military will distance themselves.
Hmm.
But really, you know, that's it. That was really scary to observe, because that's almost like observing a dictatorship where the military hold the power to perpetuating it or not, right? Where we're starting to watch whether they think the autocrat is legitimate. And the military tend to turn away from an autocrat when they feel that he has lost his legitimacy, and to support him when he still has legitimacy. And this, to us, is a clue to what is going to happen in November, right? If he loses, and he has already laid the groundwork for not recognizing his loss if people vote him out of office, we have to game this out as though this were a country where this is possible, because he's clearly signaling that it is possible. You know, the question is going to be who the military is going to be with. And that will depend on perceived legitimacy. And that will depend on how many people actually turn out to vote and vote against him.
And he did this in 4 years ago with Hillary Clinton, saying that, you know, can you believe whatever he didn't think he was going to win, so that the results will be fraudulent. And now he's talking about mail-in ballots, mail-in voting, essentially being a kind of a conspiracy by the Democrats. Masha Gessen, we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We'll get more comments from our listeners as well. And again, you're listening to Radio Times, and Masha Gessen is our guest. We're talking about their new book. It's called Surviving Autocracy. And it's based on their observations of what the United States is like under President Trump. They also wrote about Vladimir Putin and what life was like for Russia under Vladimir Putin. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Masha Gessen, who knows totalitarianism when they see it. They grew up in the Soviet Union, came to the U.S. as a teenager, returned to Russia after the fall of communism, where they wrote about the rise of Vladimir Putin. They're an author and New Yorker writer, and also have a new book titled Surviving Autocracy, which looks at President Trump's authoritarian tendencies, his regard for dictators, his use of language to confuse and obfuscate. And they join us by Skype. And you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You say, which I thought was interesting, you say corruption would not be the right word to apply to the Trump administration. The term implies deception. Why not corruption, and what's a better word?
That's a great question. I don't actually have a better word to propose, but as I sometimes try to do, I'm just drawing attention to how we're using the word corruption, and where it may be, despite our best intentions, a little bit misleading. You know, usually the opposite of corruption is transparency. Even the international organization that fights corruption in government is called Transparency International. Right. So we think of corruption as something that involves deception. That, like, when we're not looking, when we're looking the other way, something corrupt, something untoward is going on. But a lot of Trump's use of political power, the use of his office to enrich himself and his family, is happening in plain view. We can't keep track of all of it because there's so much of it. But it's not hidden. It's not a secret. I mean, yes, he hasn't shown us his tax returns, but he has completely shown us that Saudi lobbies are booking 500 nights a year at the Trump Hotel in Washington, that he's using his resorts to make money to hold political meetings, that his family is in the White House running the Trump organization and the country at the same time. This is all in plain view. So calling it corruption is a little misleading. Again, I don't have another word. I think it is often a key ingredient of autocracy, that complete melding of personal wealth and political power, where and the assumption that power begets wealth, wealth begets power, more wealth begets more power, etc.
You have some interesting commentary about Robert Mueller, the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. I think a lot of people felt like, yeah, Mueller's going to save us. As you say, institutions aren't necessarily going to save us. But you say it also drew our attention away from things that were happening, as you say, in plain view, ignoring and destroying all institutions of accountability, degrading political speech, using his office to enrich himself, according dictator after dictator, promoting xenophobic conspiracy theories. Are you saying that the Mueller investigation was a bust?
I think there was a lot of magical thinking attached to the Mueller investigation. I think there was this idea that he was going to reveal the secrets of Trump's connections to Russia, and that was going to magically make Trump disappear, right? And I'm not a Russia denialist. I'm not saying that there is no Russian interference. What I am saying is that that may not be the most important thing we needed to know about Donald Trump. That may not have been the thing that, for example, the New York Times should have devoted so many resources to for the first 2 years of the Trump presidency. And we don't have no news outlet in the world has boundless resources, and we certainly don't have boundless attention spans. And I think all that mental and emotional energy that we went that we put into observing Mueller, catching every little indication, you know, every subpoena that came out of his investigation, and waiting with bated breath for his revelations, maybe that energy would have been better spent on looking at the Trump organization and, you know, Trump resorts. I mean, some people were, like, well, my absolute favorite podcast, Trump Inc., which right? But I think our larger media organizations, I think, skewed coverage in the wrong direction for the first couple of years of the presidency.
Let me play another clip, and this again goes back a couple of years. It's July 2018. President Trump is speaking alongside Russian President Vladimir Putin. They're in Helsinki, Finland, and he's taking questions about whether he believes U.S. intelligence agencies or the Russian president whether to believe the U.S. intelligence agencies about Russian interference in the 2016 election. And he references Dan Coats, who was one of the top intelligence people. Let's give it a listen.
People came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be. So I have great confidence in my intelligence people. But I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today.
I mean, Masha, he's having an all which way there, right? Do we have Masha? We have some beeps instead of Masha. We will reconnect with Masha Gessen. And again, talking with Masha Gessen via Skype. And we have you back, I believe, Masha.
I am back, yes.
Okay, did you hear? Hopefully you heard that clip.
I remember that well. I remember that press conference very well. Yes.
I mean, some people said this is the last straw, but when you listen to it, he's having it several which ways. And there is Vladimir Putin alongside of him with that, I don't know what to call it, smirk, smile? There's something on his face, which maybe you know as a Vladimir Putin expert, what he is thinking. What is that?
It's the power smirk. I mean, he seems very self-satisfied in that press conference. And, you know, he ran that press conference. They arranged the room. They They decided who was going to take questions and how these questions were going to be orchestrated. You know, this was early days. This was before the White House press briefing went extinct. This was when we still had some ideas about maybe, you know, having accountability to the media. It was already endangered, but it was not extinct as it is now. And there was a masterclass in running a spectacle of non-accountability, right? I'm going to say things, and you know, Putin said that. Basically, he was the first one to say, "Oh, you can't trust any intelligence agencies," and then Trump parroted it. And I don't think this was a show of, "Oh, we're so deeply connected," or "He is my puppet." It was much more of a sort of show of autocrat camaraderie of we're going to perform this kind of our, we dominate the media. We're going to say what we feel like when we feel like it, and not honor this compact that we usually have with the media, which is that the reason they ask us questions is on behalf of the public to hold us accountable.
Let me get a caller. This is Mary, and Mary joining us on Radio Times. Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was wondering if your guest could comment on the support for Trump in post-Soviet immigrant communities in the U.S., Russian, I myself am Ukrainian-American, and even in the face of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we have so many people in the Russian and Ukrainian communities here supporting Trump. If you could please comment.
Mary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Masha Gessen, go ahead.
Oh God, that's such a it's heartbreaking and awful. I mean, if you look, for example, at the electoral map of New York City, where you will see only a few neighborhoods that voted for Trump in 2016, and among them are the neighborhoods with a high concentration of Russian-speaking immigrants, so people from the post-Soviet space. You know, it's not something that I have studied extensively, so it will be a bit of amateur psychology. But I think that there's this sense that that's how power is constituted, right? That's what we're raised with: the strong hand, the take control, the take charge. I mean, unfortunately, also as we know, a lot of emigres from the former Soviet space tend to be incredibly racist. And all of that, you know, Trump's campaign dog whistles and his overt racism since, I think, resonate extremely well with those communities. It's a horrible, shameful thing. Yeah.
Your book is titled "Surviving Autocracy," so there is some hope there. And you talk about, I guess, I mean, it seems to me whether you think Trump is an autocrat or not, that this country, the United States, has to really rethink or think about seriously what kind of country do we want to be once we hopefully get past this pandemic, once 40 million people hopefully get their jobs back, about what kind of country we want to be. How do you see reinvention and recovery?
Well, I think thank you for using the words reinvention and recovery, because those are the words that I use in the book, and I think they're key, right? I think there's still a bit. I think there's a lot less of it now, 3 weeks after the book came out, but there's still a bit of that sense of, oh, let's just, you know, let's have Joe Biden take us back to to the pre-Trump normal. And that's I think that's the danger. And it's also just not, you know, just crazy, because the pre-Trump normalcy, first of all, is what gave us Trump. And second of all, so much damage has been done in the 3.5 years of Trumpism, and the 4 years, hopefully, before he leaves office, that we really need to think about future-oriented politics, visionary politics that will create a new country. And I think that that's what the protests are about right now. And, you know, we know it's a commonplace in political science that that political crises are also times of opportunity. And that's what we're seeing now. And I think that what's really important about the protests, in addition to their sheer scale and ability to sustain themselves in time, is that the vast shift in political opinion that we're seeing, right? Ideas that were marginal just a few weeks ago have become subjects of legitimate debate and mainstream debate, like the ideas of defunding and abolishing the police, for example, right? That's our ticket to the future, right? Taking ideas that seemed radical and really thinking and talking about them. And that's the conversation mm-hmm. about what kind of society we want to live in, what kind of society we want to bring our children in, that is going to take us out of this hell and into a better country.
And that's Masha Gessen. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me read a couple of more emails. Ruth emails, Trump has nearly completely taken over the Republican Party, which has been his partner in nearly everything he does. They know what he is, yet not only they help him out. The Senate is the perfect example of this, in my view. Geraldo emails, it's a mistake to focus entirely on Trump. He would not be able to succeed without the support of the Mitch McConnells and the Lindsey Grahams. An email from Thomas, granting the point that Masha Gessen is making, why do 40% of the population think Trump is leading the U.S. to be great again? Why does Trump's approach seem to be working in other countries too? And if we can scroll up one more, Chris from Malaga says, well, I'm helpless here because I have a screen that I cannot control, but I'm reading. Chris from Malaga says, Obama famously said, I have a phone and a pen. Isn't the real difference between Trump and Obama just politics? Can you scroll this up a little bit more? Okay, sorry about that. Politics, and that your guest likes Obama's politics, but not Trump's politics. Any final words for our listeners, Masha Gessen, before we have to say goodbye?
I'm going to pick up. I have no idea what that last
email yeah, sorry. Means. I was half but, reading it and yes, half yes, not. But yes.
Right. I'm going to pick up on that on the somewhat earlier point about the Republican Party as a party of enablers. And that is really, really key, right? We have seen the Republican Party basically change into an autocratic type politics. And what I mean by that is that they're in democratic politics, the audience for a politician is their voters. And in autocratic politics, the audience for a politician is the autocrat, because the autocrat holds the key to power. Now, Trump holds the key to power of any elected Republican official, because if he starts attacking them on Twitter, they lose re-election. And so that's why we have seen Republican senators and congressmen turn and address Trump instead of their voters, because they're all terrified that he's going to take their seat away. Hmm. And that's how we got a party of enablers in record time.
Well, we have to end our conversation there. Masha Gessen, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And again, their book is titled Surviving Autocracy. They're a distinguished writer in residence at Bard College. I've written also a staff writer for The New Yorker and written about a dozen books. And they joined us by Skype. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for all those calls and comments.